Oh, that is wonderful.
So, yeah, in other words, after start the psalm, the Hillel.
Oh, that's wonderful.
You don't like that?
I didn't know this, so I was just listening. It's fine with me.
I actually got a book on it. Has a little book.
So for Tehillim, there are a lot of different things you could do. You can work out of a sitter, because a lot of what we'll be doing will be the chunks of Tehillim in the sitter. Art Scroll has a multi-volume Tehillim, and they have a single-volume Tehillim. There are many translations of the Psalms that you could do.
And they have a multi-volume too?
Recently.
I just had a one-volume. I didn't see them.
They put the multi-volume, they put in one big volume. So they have a big volume.
No, this was a little one.
Oh, no, that's the pocket one. But they have a big volume with a lot of commentaries. There's
and they have extra commentaries there?
They have Rav Shimshon Fal Hirsch. Hirsch has a commentary.
Which one should we buy?
Whichever you like. You look
maybe we should trade this one in.
The text is the same. The Tehillim is the same. whatever you want to buy, whatever you like.
The Art Scroll is okay.
Art Scroll is okay, yeah. Art Scroll, generally, Anach is a very hard book to use, really, because it's like so many snippets. They'll give you, five commentaries on this word, and then five commentaries on the next word. It's hard to read it as a sentence. What does the sentence say if every word has 10 interpretations? Sometimes it's easier to have a single approach to something. We'll work on it for a while, and we'll do the groups of Tehillim, starting off that we have in Davening. Hallel, the Shir of the Day, Shir Shel Yom, things like that.
Can I ask you something about Kohelet?
Yeah.
I didn't understand something. When Shlomo HaMelech says that the most important thing is to just fear God and go in his ways. I can't remember the exact wording of the last pasuk.
Right.
I thought that he really personified for us the person who took all of his physical wealth that he accumulated and was makadesh it. So is he telling us that better not to even seek, to keep one's expectations very minimal?
Well, actually, let me tell you, I talked about Kohelet and Shil yesterday, but I guess with apologies for those who were there, maybe I can repeat a little of it, because it is worthwhile to go over. We know that Kohelet is really the largest of the Megillahs. It's a very large book. And when people say the Ganze Megillah, when they think about it, that's only Purim, but Kohelet is much larger than Megillah Esther. And although it does not say explicitly Shlomo HaMelech, it says Ani Koheles ben David. Theoretically, you might have said maybe David had some son we don't know about called Koheles, but Chazal interprets very, very clearly that Koheles, which is translated even in English as the preacher, the assembler of crowds, Kahal, that this was one of Shlomo HaMelech's pseudonyms, that because he was a preacher, he was an expositor, he was one who would give guidance to people, so he called himself Koheles, and therefore this was authored by Shlomo HaMelech. And according to rabbinic tradition, we know Shlomo HaMelech wrote three books. He wrote Shir HaShirim, which of course says the Song of Songs, Asher LeShlomo. He wrote Mishlei, which is Proverbs, and he wrote Koheles. And these three books have very different moods and spirits. Shir HaShirim is a very passionate, exuberant book, describing the love of a man for a woman, but that's a metaphor for the love of Hashem Yisbarach for Klal Yisrael. That was written in the ardor of youth. Mishlei, which is very sober book, talks about the importance of not being lazy, of having good habits, good midos, industriousness, saving money, not borrowing, and a lot of prudent advice besides Avodas Hashem, but there's also many practical lessons of life in Mishlei. That was written in one's middle age, when one has kind of learned how to structure their life. I don't know if we get there, but supposedly at some point one is supposed to be able to have their life in order and be able to give guidance. And Koheles, which on one level is a very despondent book at various points, we'll talk about this, was written in his old age when he saw his life fading. And in fact, Chazal say that although the beginning of the book talks about these are the words of Koheles ben David, who was a king in Yerushalayim, but then you'll see later there's a verse that says, Ani Koheles hayisi melech, I was a king in Yerushalayim. I was a king. And Chazal say This refers to the Medrash that actually says Shlomo HaMelech at some point in his life was deposed and he lost his malchus. You may recall, this is a famous Medrash, that Shlomo wanted to capture the king of the demons, Ashmedai. And Ashmedai basically tricked Shlomo into loosening. Now, Ashmedai was trapped with a chain upon which was inscribed the name of Hashem, the Yudke Vevke. And that has a power over the demons. And Ashmedai tricked Shlomo into momentarily taking off the chain. And Ashmedai then took Shlomo, threw him 400 miles away. And Ashmedai was able to assume human shape. And Ashmedai, as it were, became the acting king. This is what the Medrash says. And Shlomo was wandering from place to place, saying, Ani Koheles Hayisi Melech, I was the king. And people say, yeah, sure, you know, and I'm, you know, I'm the president of the United States, type of thing. And he begged, and he was very poor. In fact, there are many beautiful midrashim that a lot of verses in Koheles were actually derived from his experiences as a beggar who was going from place to place. For example, there's a pasuk in Koheles that says that better a spoonful that is with gentleness and repose than all of the wealth that is with agitation and machlokas. What is the puzzle of it? Tov molo kaf nachas. And he talked about the fact that he went to two places. One was a very wealthy family in which there was dissension and machlokas, and the other was a poor family which had almost nothing to eat, but there was shalom. And you know, these were sentiments that were drawn from the bitterness of the experiences he went through. And according to one medrash, it's very interesting, he never returned to Malchus. He, I mean, it's very difficult to reconcile that with the book of Malachim, which talks about Shlomo dying as a king. But according to one Medrash, he was deposed. He never became king again. According to the other Medrash, he eventually came back. And this is the story you may have heard of, that when he finally came to Yerushalayim, and he's just like Mark Twain's Prince and the Pauper story, because he has this identical twin who looks like him. He says, I'm the king. He says, no, I'm the king. You know. And the way they told it is that demons could change their form, but they could not change their feet. They had chicken feet. They made chicken tracks. And it was noticed that Ashmedai never took off his shoes. So Shlomo's Eitzah was that somehow put sands by the bed. I'm not sure how they got him to take off his shoes. I don't remember that story. But the concept when they saw the tracks, so they were able to know that this was the demon. So anyway, the Book of Koheles comes out of some of that experience. And of course, the reason this happened to Shlomo is that Shlomo HaMelech was considered to be guilty of some very, very serious sins. In fact, it's very interesting. The Gemara in Sanhedrin comments, why is the Torah so reluctant to give us reasons for mitzvahs? We often say it's a chok, we don't ask the reason, because the Torah had a case history. The Torah gave us a reason for some mitzvahs, and it led Shlomo HaMelech astray. It says, for example, a king, lo yarbe lo nashim, a king cannot have many wives, only up to 18, no more than 18 wives. Why? Pen yasur levavo, lest his heart become distracted and will be led astray by what these women are doing to him. So Shlomo HaMelech said, I am the Chacham Mikol Adam, I am the wisest person. This isn't going to happen to me. If the Torah says it's only us, or because it's not, because this may happen, this is not going to happen to me. So he took 1,000 wives, and of course, some of them were idol worshippers, and his heart was led astray. Huh? It was his downfall. That's right. So what's the point? He thought he was smarter than HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Cheshbon, but in fact, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Cheshbon applies to everybody. Or, the other example, again, the same example, Lo Yarbe Lo Susim, he should not have a lot of horses, lest he return the people to Egypt to raise horses, right? Alexandria had the finest Arabian stallions. So Shlomo says, I'll accumulate horses and I won't send people to Egypt. Who says I have to do that? And of course, eventually he fell into that. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, you know, it's better not to give reasons for things. Because you give people reasons, and they think, well, the reason applies to A, B, and C. The reason doesn't apply to me. But the truth of the matter is, a lot of the things we think don't apply to us, apply to us anyway. So, that's why sometimes, even in halacha sometimes, again, there are different styles in halacha, but sometimes a posek does not like to get into reasons too much. Because you get into reasons, people start saying, "Wow, it doesn't apply to me." Blah blah blah. Sometimes it's better to know what the halacha is. Again, that's you could argue about that. Sometimes it's better that people also understand what they're doing. But there is a real problem when people start making a cheshbon that reasons don't apply to them. So this was a tremendous aveira. Now, the Rambam does tell us the aveira was not as obvious as you would think. If you read the book of Malachim, it seems to be that Shlomo HaMelech married non-Jewish women. He married Basparo, Egyptian women. How could that be? So the Rambam explains to us that it really wasn't an open intermarriage. Shlomo HaMelech, who is considered to be overall a righteous man, would not commit a sin like that. These women underwent a conversion. They pro forma converted to Judaism. But the halacha basically is that generally speaking, one has to be very suspicious of conversions of people who are about to marry into a royal family, mm-hmm. because one can doubt the sincerity. Well, any marriage generally, but certainly when it's a royal, you know, prestige and everything else. So the conversion was not totally sincere, and Shlomo had a responsibility to investigate the sincerity. So they were nominally Jewish, but the conversion was not sincere, and the proof of the matter was because the women eventually, some of the women at least, eventually returns to their idolatrous rites. And in fact, the Midrash describes the very painful paradox that as Shlomo built the Beis HaMikdash, that the smoke of the Karbanos of the Beis HaMikdash was wafting, was mixing together with the smoke of these women's idolatrous Karbanos to Avodah Zarah. And that was a tremendous, you know, Chil Hashem, etc., that the king should have such things. So according to the Midrash, Shlomo was actually cast, you know, into Golus by Ashmedai, and eventually he came back. But Gohelus is considered to be the product of that very, very difficult reflection. Now, Gohelus, if you read it carefully, and literally at least, seems to be a very, very depressing book, where he talks about, in fact, the dominant words in Gohelus are the first words, Havel Havalim Amar Gohelus. Well, the English is vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Gohelus is the preacher. Havel Havalim, vanity of vanities. Hakol Havel, everything is vanity. So first, again, I mentioned this in the show, you have to understand what vanity means. Vanity, as used in the biblical translation, is not the modern usage of vanity. Vanity, in the modern usage, connotes pride. But that's not what Hevel means, and that's not what vanity meant then. Vanity there meant futility. So the more accurate translation in modern usage is, everything is futile. Everything is useless. Everything is worthless. What is Hevel? Hevel literally means breath. Just as a breath, you know, has no substance, it comes out and then 1 second later you don't even feel it anymore. So too, Shlomo HaMelech is saying, I look at the world and what I see in the world is Hevel. So not vanity, but futility, uselessness, transience. And in fact, Chazal make the point that this adds up to 7 Hevels, because Havel is 1, Havalim is 2, so that's 3. Havel, Havalim, 3, 6. Hakol Havel, 7, meaning as if he's saying the entire world, universe, which is based on the 7 days of creation, even Shabbos, all of it doesn't amount to anything. It's all Hevel. Now, I just want to show you, if you look at the end of Koheles, you ask yourself, where does Shlomo come out after all of his ruminations and after all of his meditations on life? Does he come out of a better place than he was when he started? See, it's interesting that Koheles does not, Shlomo HaMelech's book actually does not end where the book ends. Shlomo HaMelech's book ends 4 psukim before. Because the last verse of Shlomo's book is Havel Havalim Amar Koheles. Hakol Havel. He ends it at exactly the note where he began it. With one difference. He actually only says Havel Havalim once instead of twice. Meaning to say, you know, it's as if somebody's in a deep depression, you know, and they're slightly less than they were at the beginning. You know, that's progress too. He took out one Havel Havalim, as it were. You see, because the end of Koheles, again, if you don't have a Chumash, it's hard to show you this. The end of Koheles is an editorial edition that was put in by the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the people of the Great Assembly at the time of the Second Temple. They were deciding what books go into the Tanakh and what books don't. So they put in a superscription. They put in a conclusion to the book that says that not only, and I'll translate for you, not only was Kohelis a wise man, but he was a person who taught people knowledge, and he investigated and he examined many different parables. Now Shlomo didn't write that about himself. That would be conceited. This was written by the editors, as it were. And then it talks about, so it turns out this way, and then it says at the end, "And my son, be careful. Of the making of books there is no end." Now, let me explain what is going on here. What's going on here is that when the Chachamim had to decide, you know, there are many books which were written in the time of the Tanakh, which were not included in the Tanakh. They are called the Apocrypha in English, or they're called Svarim Chitzonim, the external books, the excluded books. For example, the Book of the Maccabees, although it's a later time, you know, is not in the Tanakh. But there are books even dating very early, the Book of Ben Sira, which is a book of wisdom, but it was decided that it did not rise to the level of divine inspiration. So there had to be a discussion. The Chachamim discussed what books are considered to be divinely inspired, so they enter the Tanakh, and what books are excluded, because they don't. So it says, Bikshu Chachamim lignos es Kohelis. When the Chachamim, at the time of the Second Temple, are looking at Ecclesiastes, at Kohelis, not only did they not want to include it in the Tanakh, but they wanted to put it in Shemus. They wanted to withdraw it from general circulation. They thought, there are too many ideas in this book which, if taken out of context, cause a person not to believe in God. For example, he says in some place, again, there's so many verses, if you take them out of context, that is, he says, better never to have been born than to live and know that you're going to die. He says, when you die, you go back to the earth from where you came. And he says, and who knows if the soul goes up and the animal goes down, or vice versa, or the animal and the man are the same, human being are the same. In other words, there are statements that deny, or at least suggest skepticism, regarding resurrection of the dead, regarding Olam Haba. There are statements that say, in fact, the famous phrase that we say in English, eat, drink, and be merry. It's from Kohelis, right? Eat, where there are statements of hedonism. So the Chachamim felt very, very frightened that if one reads Kohelis, one might be led on the road of disbelief and heresy. There are also statements where Kohelis cries out to God, why are righteous people oppressed? Right, the famous old question. But Kohelis talks about it. I have seen many good people are oppressed by evil people, and there is no justice in this world, etc. So all of these sentiments, hedonism, skepticism regarding Olam Haba, potential denial of the justice of God, these are all thoughts, again, as I emphasize, if you take it out of context, if you pull out an isolated pasuk here and a pasuk here, you will see these things. So the Chachamim said, you know, maybe this is a book that we should not have Jewish people reading. Well, yeah, so they put it in shame. But then they realized that, of course, in all good things there are costs, there are risks, as it were, but ultimately the message that goes is a holy message. And what they did was, they, in order that people should get the message, they put five verses at the end of Kohelis that kind of encode or decode the message. Meaning to say, the five verses is not Shlomo HaMelech's writing, but it's kind of telling you, first of all, reader, know that King Solomon was not this heretic or this hedonist that you might describe him as, but he was a wise person who was committed to teaching. That's one thing. Then it mentions that maybe, it's kind of almost humorous, that it warns people about not writing too many books, meaning it's as if to say, well, we're letting this through, but you know, maybe people writing down all their books isn't the greatest idea, because when there are so many books out there, there are going to be ideas that can be dangerous. And then it says, Sof Davar, the famous verse, the end of the matter, what is the meaning of this book? Is to fear Hashem, which means revere Hashem, and keep His commandments, because that is the purpose of every human being. But that is the decoding. Shlomo, in his book of Kohelis, tends not to be as explicit. He teaches by a lot of subtle indirection. And the question is, where do you get from A to B? Meaning to say, you read all of Koheles, it's almost as if, you know, he's discussing, you know, maybe there's no God, maybe there's no resurrection, maybe there's no soul, maybe there's no justice, enjoy life. But the bottom line is believe in Hashem. I mean, that doesn't seem to be the conclusion that emerges from a lot of the book. A lot of the book. Now, there are certainly verses in the book where on one hand Koheles says, and also another thing you have to understand is that sometimes in biblical poetry there is a certain measure of sarcasm. So for example, in one of the psukim, Shlomo says, eat, drink, and be merry, and enjoy yourself while you can. But then he says, but know that God shall eventually hold you to account. In other words, it's kind of, you know, if somebody just pulls out the first half of the verse, eat, drink, and enjoy yourself, without pulling out the second half of the verse, you realize that what he's really saying is, you can do what you want, but recognize that we are accountable to Hashem. So sometimes you have to be careful in taking, even looking at the heretical ideas, to see that it's counterbalanced by another point. I'm sorry.
And Koheles, I think that he married those particular women for political alliances.
Yes.
I think when the text about the more men, the more people, the more wives, the more, what is that, the more...
Well, the more promiscuity, it says in Pirkei Avos. Marbe zima. Zima is adultery or promiscuity. More property, the more more property, the more worry, etc. Yeah. Yeah.
And he said nothing new. The Beatles, for instance, I think there's nothing new in the sign.
Right,
the
yeah. That's right. Bob Dylan, I think, is a song. A lot of Koheles has been put to music, Jewish or non-Jewish, for that. Now, if you read Koheles, though, the Havel Havelim, again, I mentioned again, my apologies for those who heard some of this, there are really three like negative attitudes that come through the book. In other words, he looks at a world in which so much of life seems pointless and useless. I mean, that's the basic thing that he's describing all the time. That whatever you do, like, falls apart. You know, we die and no one remembers us. We accumulate wealth, we don't take it with us. And how does a person respond to the fact that so much of what we do really does not have an enduring value? So there are three attitudes that pop out in this book at various times. One is the attitude of the hedonist that says, you're not going to be here tomorrow, so you might as well enjoy it, live it up while you can. That's the eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. Although the tomorrow we will die is not in Koheles in itself, that part. But certainly he emphasizes some point to enjoy it while you can, because there's nothing afterwards. Death is final. Right? Those are the references to when you're dead, you're dead. No one remembers you, no one cares about you, etc. And that's it. That's one negative attitude. The second attitude is what we would call the Greek attitude of stoicism or apathy. In other words, the concept is that if whatever you do doesn't matter, then you train yourself not to care. You train yourself not to be affected. Right? What is a stoic personality? A stoic is everything's the same. You don't get upset. You don't get happy. You kind of, that's Havel Havelim. Havel Havelim, on one level, could be the attitude of the stoic that says, the pain is not real and the pleasure is not real. And therefore one simply absents themselves from life. The third attitude is the pain of a sensitive person who sees suffering in the world. And this is the point where Koheles at one point cries out when he says, I see injustice. I see the poor being hurt. I see people starving, right? I see babies dying. So Koheles is struggling in his own life with the hedonist impulse, which is really ego and selfishness, to kind of take from this world for yourself, between the notion of the apathy, where I can't let this bother me, and the pain of sensitivity. Now you understand that, particularly the last two, is something that we struggle with all the time. Let's take for example physicians who deal, or nurses, or people who deal with, you know, children who have cancer. Okay, there is a concept where sometimes you cannot allow yourself to feel the pain of what's going on. You have to emotionally distance yourself because it destroys you from within. And yet, of course, when a human being stops feeling compassion, then they become non-human. They become very different. They become a robot. And Koheles, again, if you read the book carefully, it's hard to point at such a big Megillah, but if you point out various verses, you will see that at some time Shlomo HaMelech vacillates between kind of a passivity by saying, this is the way the world is, and I can't do anything about it, and it's too bad, and the notion of pain, what can I do? In other words, the pain that I feel when I see the Ashukim are the oppressed people who are broken and smashed. Right? So we have hedonism, stoicism, and pain towards the suffering of others. I'm trying to think where I believe it's in the Chumash, but I don't think it's in the
Oh, okay, here it
is. Yeah, Koheles is in the Hirsch Chumash here. Okay, so these are the things that he's vacillating with. These are the things that all of us go through, meaning to say, in our own struggle. Now, of course, at various points, see, that's why a book of Tanakh can never be read. The book of Iyov is really the same thing. Except the book of Iyov, many people have pointed out there's a difference. Koheles and Iyov deal with a lot of the same themes, and that is human suffering, the fact that what we do does not survive us.
So how do you answer that question?
I'll come to it. But I just want to say that Eve is treated as the paradigm of the person who cries out and argues and refuses to accept. Koheles is often described as the skeptic or the stoic, who kind of withdraws and says, this is the way the world is, and it's evil anyway, and why should I be concerned? But in Koheles, we see that vacillation back and forth. And at various points, just as Eve sometimes makes statements which are not reflective of his ultimate belief, such as, you know, he calls God unjust, and Koheles at some point says, who knows when you die, whether you go to the same place of the animal or not. But the Chachamim made the point. See, the Chachamim don't whitewash and say, oh, every pasuk in which a bad sentiment is expressed has to be reinterpreted. But they make the point in the book of Iyov, Ein Adam Nitfas Al Sara. A person is not fully accountable for what they say when they're in great pain and agitation. People sometimes say things. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu understands that that's not always what they mean, but they say it in a moment of anger, in a moment of pain, in a moment of fear. And some of what you, when you read these books, some of this you have to understand are the feelings that emerge from a person at a moment of great despair. That sometimes, and that makes the book very universal, because sometimes, even in the heart of a believer, there sometimes come doubts, there sometimes are questions, there are sometimes even attacks. Again, ultimately we have to try to believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is just, and if in this world we don't know why good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people, etc. Of course, the Ramban points out, everyone always has a question.
There's a greater picture.
You know, why do bad things happen to good people? Right, but no one ever has the question, why do good things happen to me? We ask, why do bad things happen? We don't question, why do good things happen? That we think is natural.
It's coming to us.
But you know, but the truth of the matter is saying, you know, there's a larger picture. Again, I don't have an ultimate answer. Remember, in fact, the Torah reading of yesterday, Shabbos Chol HaMoed, right, when Moshe Rabbeinu, after the golden calf, asks God, Hodieni na esterachacha, show me your ways. Show me your ways. And God says in a mysterious way, I will put you in the cleft of the rock, and I will cover you up till I pass by, and you will see me. I'm just quoting the Chumash. You will see me from the back, but you will not see me from the front, because no person can see God from the front and live. Very mysterious. I mean, God doesn't have a back, God doesn't have a front. I mean, God is not a physical body. But the Gemara explains that Moshe's question was, he wanted to understand divine justice. He wanted to know, how do we explain the suffering of good people and the prosperity of evildoers? Why is it, this is called tzaddik, right? Theosophy is the fancy term for it. But tzaddik v'ra'lo, why do righteous people suffer? Why do evildoers prosper? And Hashem basically said, and this is how it's interpreted, you will not understand this from the front, meaning while it's happening, you won't understand it. but you can understand it from the back, meaning in retrospect. Now, the retrospect may be at the end of days, Mashiach. In other words, you will see. In other words, the analogy that's given is your actors in a play who have memorized a few lines. Right? Imagine if you had a play which spans the totality of world history from the beginning to the end. And you're given a page, and the page says you're to slip on a banana peel and break your leg. That's your role. And you go to the director and you say, that's not fair, why do I break my leg? And the director says, you don't know what came before, you don't know what came after. This is so essential to the structure of the drama. That's the concept that in retrospect, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, at the Kovnik, he was, we have an eyewitness account, he was killed in the Kovnik ghetto, one of the Lithuanian ghettos, and he gave the mushal of a field. I think I mentioned this before, the mushal of a field where a boy wanted to learn how to make bread, how do you grow wheat. So he was a city boy, so he went out to the country, and he sees a beautiful, lush field of green grass. So it's very, very pretty. And then one day, the whole thing gets plowed up, and it turns into mud. And he says, why did you destroy the grass? He says, don't worry. They plant the seed grows up into golden wheat. He says, oh, now I understand. You destroyed the grass to have this beautiful golden wheat. And then they harvest the wheat. And he says, why did you destroy the wheat? In other words, the point is, every stage looked at in isolation is destructive. Mm-hmm. But when you see the total picture, you see. Now, again, one of the difficult issues is, again, you take the Holocaust, right? So according to that paradigm, we would say, well, the Holocaust somehow fits in. But then you have another variable, and that is, there's also human free will. Meaning to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu leaves to human beings the choice to do good or do evil. On that level, so how do you reconcile that? If a human being has the unfettered ability to do good or do evil, how do you then say that it's part of God's plan? See, on that level, God did not decree the Holocaust. It was every human being who made their own decision to do evil. Right? No Nazi could go to God and say, I carried out your will. Right? That would be preposterous. Every person who does evil is accountable for that evil. Right? So, this is really a mystery. The mystery is, do we view things God's plan or human choice? See, one response to the Holocaust could be very simple in effect, and that is, it's not God's doing at all. It says, how could God allow this to happen? And the answer is, because God created a world where human beings have the capacity of choice. Goodness is good only if you choose it, right? Otherwise, you live in a world where you're just an automatic pilot.
At this point,
and if goodness is a function of choice, then choice has to go the other way too. Mm-hmm. In other words, God has to let, because if you could only make the choice on one side of the equation, it's not choice. So one approach might be, God lets human beings do what they do to themselves, because that is the principle in which goodness is a function of choice, as opposed to compulsion. But that, in a sense, contradicts the idea that everything fits into a plan. Right? So we have these two models. The model of God's plan versus human choice. Right? It's very complicated. So how do you reconcile that? Right? And one way of looking at it is that God is a master chess player. Now, if one is a great chess player, so the chess player does not control your moves, but the chess player can turn any possible move you make into their advantage and their end. So the concept is that God has infinite scenarios that can be spun out through billions and trillions of human interactions, which are autonomous decisions. But God, in other words, you know, the Pentagon, it says that the Pentagon has contingency plans for every possible war that can exist in the world, meaning to say, if Thailand, you know, decides to declare war on Brazil, so they have a plan there. You know, every type of possibility, how they would respond. That's what the story goes. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kavyachal has contingency plans for any possible sum total. Imagine how complicated, of trillions of human decisions, which are made by autonomous actors. So, the concept of God's plan doesn't mean that God directed that to happen. but God eventually enlists it and turns it into something good. Now again, we don't have a right, really, to talk about what good came from the horrendous tragedies of our century. We need Nevi'im, without prophets we can't say it. But again, but one could say, again, one does see that the survival of the Jewish people, the Eretz Yisrael, yeshivas, balei tshuva, that the energy that was released from having to rebuild from Churban was a tremendous bracha. This doesn't answer the Holocaust, and we can't answer the Holocaust. But it's very unfair to HaKadosh Baruch Hu only to look at the devastation that occurred in this century and not to look at the equally great miracle of the survival of the Jewish people, notwithstanding that tragedy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a miracle too. If the Holocaust is an evil that we cannot explain, the growth of Klal Yisrael after the Holocaust is a miracle that we cannot explain either. And you know, we have to not just accuse HaKadosh Baruch Hu of that part, but there's another part of the equation too.
How do you reconcile the fact that Hashem knows everything and the fact that there are all these possible scenarios?
Yeah, well, the Rambam says that's one of the famous conundrums in Jewish philosophy. Yediyas Hashem, God's omniscience, God's total knowledge. In other words, God knows whether you're going to speak Lashon Hara today or not. You wake up in the morning, you have total choice. Mm-hmm. But you say, wait a second here. God knows what I'm going to do. Do I have the choice to do the other way? No, I don't. Because if God knows I'm going to do it, when I wake up in the morning, I don't have the choice. So how do you reconcile that? It's a difficult question. I mean, the Ravid suggests that God's knowledge is analogous to a parent that knows their child. Meaning to say, your child gets up. And let's say your child always has cereal in the morning. Now your child gets up, the child has the choice to have peanut butter or cereal. That's their choice. But you know what they're going to choose.
Mm-hmm.
So God knows us very well. He knows what we're going to choose. But he does not make the choice.
Mm-hmm.
God just knows what we are going to choose.
I don't see I think in all the scenarios, still God would know what decisions are going to be, what scenarios are going to do.
Right.
I also, in other words, all the things the Pentagon would do for it.
Right.
He would know which would, because of a mission, which would be. I don't think it's such a professional thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then I also feel that, when Hashem turns the Arabot, it meets our free will. That's when I think we have shalom.
Yep.
If not, I think then you have a milk and milk. And in the Nazi aspect, the Holocaust, I think that there would have been Eretz Yisrael regardless.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'd be illumined by Hashem. One should not forget man's inhumane aspect towards man.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we should excuse that.
Of course. No, absolutely.
But it's my belief that we still have our peace that regardless of that.
Well, eventually, certainly Hashem would bring Mashiach.
We believe Hashem would bring
the redemption.
Yeah,
Hashem would bring Mashiach, but when? You don't know when it would happen.
You know, it's not interrelated.
By the way, just to give you another example of how it's so difficult to predict alternative scenarios in history, you know, one of the criticisms that is sometimes made against the religious leadership in Europe, some of the Gedolim in Europe, is they did not encourage Aliyah from Poland prior to World War II, where the British were still relatively liberal, because that would have gotten a lot of Jews out of Europe, and they could have been in Eretz Yisrael, and they could have been saved. But this is a criticism that the Zionist movement makes. But it's very, very interesting that, you know, when Rommel was involved in North Africa, and at various points in his North African campaign, the question was whether he would conquer Palestine. But one of the reasons why Hitler diverted gasoline and all sorts of military supplies back to Poland was there weren't enough Jews in Palestine to make it worth the while. They wanted to devote it to concentration camps in Poland, where you had the big... So it's very, very fascinating. In other words, if all the Jews would have gone to Eretz Yisrael, then indeed the whole military campaign would have changed. So you can't predict things on a static model. In other words, you can't assume everything would have been the same. Hitler would have, you know, fought in Poland, and all the Jews would be in Eretz Yisrael. That would have changed the dynamics of the war itself. So it's very, very difficult to be a chacham in retrospect in those matters.
Who
we say that let's say things happen with Bechira Chavshis because, let's say, Hitler and Yimach Shemo decided to do it and every person had a decision, does that mean that each person that died, though, died because that was his goral, or because...
So that's another question. So that's another question. The question is, you know, somebody walks into a 7-Eleven, robs the 7-Eleven, pulls out a gun, and shoots somebody dead. Now, on one level, God did not make that person pull the trigger. That was a person's choice. That's Bechira. God let a person decide, am I going to kill somebody or not? So the question then becomes, if shooting the trigger is a function of Bechira, is it possible, therefore, that people died when it was not God's will that they die at that given moment in time?
Just like Nachshon.
Right. Now, the Aruch Chaim... I'm sorry.
Bechira,
free will, free choice. The Aruch Chaim HaKadosh actually says, and this is a Chiddush, I don't think it's accepted by the mainstream, that victims who are subject to human choice can be killed even if it is not God's will that they be killed, because they're simply the outgrowth of human Bechira. In fact, the Aruch Chaim says, I'll tell you where he says this by. He says this by, why was it? It says, Yosef's brothers, Reuven convinced Yosef's brothers to throw Yosef in the pits instead of killing him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, according to Chazal, the pit was filled with snakes and scorpions. So, so you could say Reuven didn't know that, you could say that, but if they knew that, snakes and scorpions kill a person almost instantly. So what's Reuven's thing? We don't kill him, let's throw him into escapes the snakes and scorpions. The Aruch Chaim says the following. The Aruch Chaim says that snakes and scorpions cannot kill a person unless it is God's will that the person die at that moment. But human beings can kill a person even if it's not God's will, because animals act only according to the Ratzon of Hashem. Human beings are Balei Bechira. An amazing thing. So in effect, what Reuven is saying is, I didn't say Goyim, I'm saying human beings.
Human beings, you can go in and do it too.
Jew or Goyim, I didn't say animals, I'm talking about human beings right now. I'm comparing snakes and scorpions.
Right.
So the Aruch Chaim says an amazing thing. If you throw somebody into snakes and scorpions, the snakes will not kill him unless it's God's will. Now, normally, I guess it'll be God's will, because normally that happens. But a human being could do it. Now, that's why David HaMelech says, Nipla na biyad Hashem. I would rather be in the hands of God and not to fall in the hands of man.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say that I think that the Aruch Chaim's position is not accepted by many opinions. And many opinions kind of do this chess game thing again, meaning to say, I choose to shoot the gun, but Hashem will arrange which person will be in the store at that time. Now again, I want to emphasize, first of all, don't misunderstand me. This is not at all saying that everybody who gets hurt, everybody who gets killed, deserves it in some moral sense. God forbid. That's not to say, the guy who died deserves to die. In other words, all we mean to say is that for whatever reason, Hashem decreed that that person die. It doesn't mean, chas v'shalom, the person is bad. Again, this goes back to the mystery. Why Hashem decrees that people die? We don't know. One reason is, people do have a natural duration. In fact, I think I told you before, Rosh Hashanah. You know, people ask the kasha, we see on Rosh Hashanah, Rishayim Gemurim, evildoers are sealed for death. There are many evildoers who live out the year. So the Maharal explains like this. The Maharal says, when it says a tzaddik is inscribed for life and a rasha is inscribed for death, that doesn't mean for sure the tzaddik will live or the rasha will die. But the Maharal says the following. When a person is born in this world, they are given a natural allotment. In other words, a natural allotment. A person is born, and it is decreed at the time that they're born that this person will live or can live up to 10 years, 5 years, 3 years, 1 year, 100 years, right? Whatever it is. Now, in the course of our lives, through the mitzvahs or the averos we do, we can shorten it or lengthen it. But we start off with an allotment.
So the Maharal says, when Hashem decrees that a Rasha will die, all that means is the following. If, and only if in the coming year, it is the Rasha's natural end, it is up Kapaskin than Rosh Hashanah, that Hashem is not going to give him any breaks. But that doesn't mean he'll die, because if this is not his natural end, in other words, mm-hmm. if his natural end is 20 years from now, he'll live another 20 years. It doesn't mean he'll die, but it means I will not give him, Hashem says, an extension beyond the allotment. Now, a tzaddik will be given an extension beyond the allotment. But that, ironically, might still mean he'll die within the year. Because let's assume the tzaddik's natural allotment was Rosh Chodesh Cheshvan, a month after Rosh Hashanah. When Hashem inscribes him for life, that means, you know, because this is a righteous man, I'll give him an extra month. So, you see the paradox. So the paradoxical, interesting thing about this explanation is, the Rasha was inscribed for death, and he may live out the whole year. The tzaddik was inscribed for life, and he may die a week later. But the pshat is that for the tzaddik it was an extension, and for the Rasha there was no extension. It's a very, I mean, again, it's kind of a way, at least intellectually, to understand this. Otherwise, it's an inexplicable statement that the Rasha is inscribed and sealed for death in the coming year when they don't die, always. And the tzaddik is inscribed for life. Now, you could say, of course, all of that refers to Olam Haba, mm-hmm. but that's not really true, because if you look in the prayers of Rosh Hashanah, the prayers of Rosh Hashanah make it very, very clear that we're not just talking about, you know, who will get the world to come. We are talking about what will happen to you in this world, right?
Well,
the Son of Tov.
Right, yeah. Now, nowadays, we live longer, in
yes.
general.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
Like, in general, the average year is 80 years old.
Right. And of course, not as long as Bracious, say for Bracious, 930.
Righteous, yep. or that we need. I mean, all of. I'm not talking about individual people. I'm talking about the whole.
Words, how do you understand the increased life expectancies in terms of an allotment of years?
Exactly. In yeah. terms of mm-hmm. In terms of what you just said, you know, Hashem gave the scientists the ability to find things, the ability to find cancer early, the ability mm-hmm. to do things, and yet I see all around us is chaos.
Yeah.
More than anything else. So what does that mean?
Maybe it means sometimes when you're not such a righteous person, you need more years to kind of try to do the good. There is a concept. It says in Hallel, Yokor be'enei Hashem amav salach hasidav. Now, it's an interesting pasuk, yakar. Yakar can mean precious. It is precious to God, the death of his pious ones. Meaning that God sometimes desires the death of a righteous person so the soul can be with God. The other interpretation of yakar is grievous, heavy. Mm-hmm. But there is a concept that when the tzaddik finishes his mission, you know, he goes back to Shemayim right away.
But I'm talking about the whole...
No, but it could very well be. I'm saying it could very well be that as generations are not as spiritually fine,
right.
they need more years to do the job. That might be part of it.
That's an easy answer, Rabbi.
I don't have an answer. It's an
impossible
answer.
Nobody can tell
that.
We
don't know.
We're finite within us.
Right.
But first of all, you would see order in the universe, not chaos in
yes.
general.
Well, in the natural
world. But you
wouldn't
say that people would just try to perfect someone for Olam Haba because they're living in Olam Hazeh, right?
Mm-hmm.
If someone doesn't perfect someone just for Olam Haba, then they may don't have a right to live in Olam Hazeh.
That's correct.
So
yep.
People just don't do everything for Olam Haba, which is
our job for mitzvos is in this world. I mean, we do our mitzvos, right? I mean, Hashem put us in this world to do mitzvos. In fact, it was interesting that the Gemara records an argument between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, that for 3 years they argued, is it better for a person to be created or not created? Maybe you're better off had you never been created. And they finally came to the conclusion, you know, it would have been better for a person never to have been created. But now that you're created, you got to make the best of it and do the mitzvahs. It's interesting. The Maharsha gives a numerical calculation. Why is it better not to be created? He says like this. We have in the Torah 365 negative commandments. Thou shalt not do. And we have 248 positive commandments. Thou shalt do. Now if you're dead or you're not created, you are keeping, in a sense, or you're not violating the 365 negatives, but you're not doing the 248 positives. When you're created, you have the potential for doing 248 positives, but you also have the potential for violating 365 negatives. So the Marsha says, the gambling person would say, you know, the odds are better if I'm not created. Because if I'm not created, I automatically got 365 things that are not to my demerits, as it were. If I am created, right? So actually you have that problem. And of course, Kohelis says in many places, what does Kohelis say? Kohelis says at one point, better a person who was never born than a person who was born and knows that they're going to die. Right? That's part of the despondency of Kohelis. But I just want to say that there's a beautiful interpretation. The phrase in Hebrew is, Noach li adam shelo nivra, which is normally translated, better for a person that he were never created. But the Baal HaTanya, the Alter Rebbe, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, says that the translation of Noach is not it is better, but Noach is it is easier. In other words, he says, it would be easier for a person not to be created. Meaning, what would that mean? We don't mean total non-existence. You wouldn't even know that. But it means it would have been easier if the soul would be in Shemayim with God. Be nana mizif hashchina, to get the pleasure of the divine presence. And not to come to an earth which is so much struggle and so much ambiguity and so much suffering. It would have been not better, it would have been easier. But the goal is not to have an easy existence. The goal is indeed to confront this world. And as the Baal HaTanya writes, to make this world a dira, a residence for the Shekhinah. That you want to bring the Shekhinah in the dark places. And therefore he says, you know, in fact there's even a song in one of the Jewish records about how the Neshama, when it comes to earth, begs God not to go. I want to stay here. This is so comfortable for me and so good for me. And Hashem says, you have to go. And then 120 years later, Hashem wants the Neshama to come home. And the Neshama says, no, no, I like it here. He says, don't you remember? Don't you remember what it was like? And the Neshama says, in fact, I mentioned on Yom Kippur, a famous mashal of the Dubner Magid, how the soul comes to earth with such a desire to be close to Hashem. But over time, it forgets. It forgets. And when Hashem wants the Neshama back, the Neshama doesn't want to go. And the mashal the Dubner Magid gives is a man who had a poor family and he wanted to support a family. So he was told that in the faraway islands, there's so much gold and silver that it's on the streets. And all he has to do, like they say about America, America had gold on the streets. They used to, you could pick it up. So he goes to the island after many, you know, many months, he gets there. And indeed, he sees gold and silver everywhere. And he starts picking it up, picking it up. And then people walk by and say, what are you doing? Why are you picking up that garbage? He says, this is gold and silver. He says, so what? It's everywhere. So he says, well, what's valuable in this island? He says, onions are valuable. We don't have onions. If you could find onions, that would be the most wonderful thing. So eventually, he hears this every day, how the gold and silver is worthless and nothing and garbage and onions. So finally, he begins to think, you know, maybe onions are really what is valuable in life. So he starts traveling around the island, going to the mountains in the island, and the deserts is kind of a large island. And finally, like, he finds some rare onions and he collects them lovingly. And finally, after years, he feels he has enough onions to take back to his family in Europe. And he packs the onions, and he goes on the boats. And somehow he tells his family that he's coming, he sends a message. And they're so excited that they'll see him, and finally he'll take them out of poverty. And when he comes back, all he brings back are onions. And they're all rotten. And they say, onions? I mean, onions, onions, you can get so many onions here. And the Dubner Magid said, that is really the mashal for a human neshama. A human neshama comes into this world and is told to amass wealth of diamonds, golds, and mitzvahs. Those are the mitzvahs in the Torah. But after a while, day after day, you know, mitzvahs are so easy in this world. There are so many mitzvahs that you have. They're around all the time. you know, you say good morning to somebody. It's a mitzvah. You make somebody feel good. But after a while, you keep on hearing mitzvahs, this, that. The real thing is the money you make, the materialism, whatever it is. And after a while, that's what you hear. So you accumulate all of this stuff, and then when you finally go home, the Rebbe Maggid says, you come back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu with boxes of onions, which are worthless up there, because we never bothered accumulating the wealth that we could have accumulated here. That's what the Rebbe Maggid said. And therefore the Bala Tanya writes, Nayach Liadim would be a lot easier had we not had to go through this trip. But that wouldn't be the purpose. The whole purpose of our lives is indeed to engage in this struggle.
The story of David HaMelech, where he started out with no years, right? His life
That's
was
right.
going to be...
3 hours. Yeah.
Okay, 3 hours. When did that change? Because you're talking about a natural allotment, his natural allotment. Do we get that increased or decreased each year, or is that something that happens spontaneously?
No, it seems to be that the natural allotment is assigned at birth, or maybe even before you were born, at the very beginning of time. And then, one of the things that could happen on Rosh Hashanah is your allotment could be increased or decreased because of good and bad, but that's not an automatic process. In other words, according to the Maharal, the only automatic thing that we say is that if one is a Rosha, he will not be given an extra allotment, and if one is a Tzaddik, they'll be given something extra. But it does not say that the Rosha will automatically be curtailed. Maybe Hashem will let the Rosha have his natural allotment.
But wasn't David HaMelech's allotment before he was born?
Yes, yes, but that was different because that's Adam. Adam made a deal with God. In other words, if you remember, Adam HaRishon gave up 70 years of his life. So that was a special, that was a private deal. I mean, you can't generalize that. I mean, Adam HaRishon advocated on behalf of David with Hashem, and he gave David 70 years. That's why Adam should have lived 1,000 years. And he lived 930. By the way, this was a concept that was done in Europe a lot. I don't know if it's done now, where sometimes when you have Gedolim or Tzaddikim who are dying, and they would be surrounded by their disciples. Right? I've seen many accounts, and the disciples would say, I give the Rebbe 1 year of my life. I give the Rebbe 1 year of my life. People would say. So there was, you know, I can't say if it worked per se, you know, I don't know, but there was a concept that you could trade in these things, similar to what Adam HaRishon did. They asked the Chafetz Chaim, this is also a story they tell, they asked the Chafetz Chaim one of these things, would he give, you know, something? And the Chafetz Chaim like, thought a half an hour and said, I'll give 10 minutes. And people think, well, it's a little callous. But he says, no, when someone really has an appreciation of time, for us 10 minutes is nothing. And the 10 minutes was a very, very, he thought about it very carefully, about the mitzvahs you can do in 10 minutes, and he says 10 minutes was a very, very valuable gift. It's someone, only someone who treasures time could say that. You know. In fact, the Chafetz Chaim said that when his son became bar mitzvah, he gave his son a watch. He says, this is the most precious gift I can give you, is the gift of learning to use your time, because your time is your life.
But Hashem has no time. Is it, that was like created the universe.
Hashem has no time. Yeah, well, that's true. Hashem is above time. But we human beings are very much creatures of time.
But Einstein was talking about outer space, and then you have a different kind of time, too. And then if you're older or younger, depending on if you're in Israel, for instance, with a time difference, though.
Yeah.
It's actually relative, right?
Well, yeah, okay. I mean, yes. You know, some say, you know, the story about the Jewish astronaut who came down and he was very, very exhausted because he was davening Shacharis Mincha Maariv followed by Shacharis Mincha Maariv. According to some opinions, if you're constantly going through the revolutions and you're traveling faster than the Earth, so you're going through sunrises and sunsets all the time. So it's a very complicated question. Exactly how do you keep mitzvahs in space? Now, the simplest answer is that the Torah was given to Earth, and the Torah does not apply in space, and therefore Jews are not allowed to go into space. There is such an approach.
Oh, really?
That's a simple answer, but if one takes the other views, it's a very complicated issue.
I want to ask one more thing.
Yeah.
As the question is, why is it, you know, when born, really, there's, I hate to say this, there's some pseudo-aspects to the question that you just sent by Shemford.
Yeah, I understand, but the point that that's what the Gemara is saying, that in some ideal state, the neshama might be happier had it not been born, but that's not the goal. The goal is to struggle. In fact, the way the Ramchal writes, or Moshe Chaim Litzato writes,
you have to improve your neshama.
Well, your neshama needs to go through the process of struggling to become perfected.
Right.
He says like this. He uses the imagery. This is the Aramaic phrase, Nahama de Kisufa, bread of shame. That which one gets without earning is embarrassing. The neshama is embarrassed to get all the goodness of God without struggling to earn it. And therefore it was God's bracha that we go and we try to earn.
I think that our purpose is not to have people struggle. I think that's why Hashem gave fruit trees. He's milked the children fruit trees.
Yes.
That we should imitate Hashem and not try to make people struggle.
Struggle, yeah.
I'm not sure if
we all struggle anyway.
No, but struggle, I understand what you mean. Struggle, I mean two things. I don't mean that Hashem's goal is that we should necessarily struggle in making a living. I mean, there's no mitzvah bedafka to struggle.
No, I mean struggling with anything.
Well, struggle means yetzer hara, that we have struggles in terms of deciding. In other words, Hashem did not make it automatic that we will always do mitzvahs.
But, I mean,
we have
yetzer hara. If someone's basically good, I don't think they have to go around saying it has to be yetzer hara.
Right. It's a reality. The HR is a reality of the human being. We try to perfect, we try to rise above it. We do tshuva every year, because not every year, every day really.
Also, you have many Arabim and Jews that have money that are very religious, and I don't think that is, again, a blocking aspect, particularly when they use these things to enhance the religion, like not that they're having a place, you know, with gold rims, like my mommy says, to show the Joneses, they have it for glorification.
No, yeah. When I say struggle, I'm not suggesting that there's a mitzvah to be poor. I don't mean that. I mean that might be
no,
the particular struggle that a person
that
has.
You have a struggle
even
with your own philosophical aspects.
Well, let's put it this way. I mean, the process of growth and the process of becoming more of a servant of Hashem does involve struggle. Because if a person simply says, "I am fine the way I am." There's a little bit of a problem in that. That's complacency.
I don't know if you should always be placed on proving you're a bad person.
Yeah, no. That's for
Shelley.
The message is not that you're a bad person, but you try to become a better person.
Right.
You're good, and we try to become better. It's the opposite. The person has to believe that they're good in order to try to become better. If a person believes they're bad, they often feel there's no hope. Becoming better presupposes that one is good. And that's how you have to look. I guess it's a good point to reiterate again. A person has to look at themselves as essentially as good in the eyes of God, beloved in the eyes of God. And then to look, what can I do in my life to bring God more pleasure? Hashem has a lot of nachas from us, and He wants to have more nachas. What can I do? You know, it's that's tshuva. One looks at tshuva means returning to God.
Well, excuse me, what would be a good mafashim to study for the Kohelas?
Our
Shabbos group is going
to there is
do
Art
that.
Scroll on Kohelas. There's another book, Brach. It's published by Feldheim. The author is B-R-O-C-H, Brach. That's probably easier to
published
use.
Published by whom?
Feldheim.
Feldheim.
Then they have the Judaica Press, which has all the books of Tanakh, and Sansina, which is okay.
Right.
But Gorelis is a problematical book. I haven't really finished it, even what my few comments on Gorelis are. But I think that one helpful way of approaching the book is to focus on a new translation of the word Hevel, right? Hevel, which is translated as futile, right? Things are futile, which connotes worthlessness, can also mean something else. Remember, Hevel comes from the word for breath. And breath may not connote futility. After all, human beings have to breathe. But breath connotes impermanence, transience, here today, gone tomorrow. Now, when someone says about life that life is here today, gone tomorrow, you know, it doesn't last. That may not suggest its worthlessness or its futility, but that may suggest its preciousness. In other words, Kohelis might be looking at life and saying that life is so precious and dear precisely because we're going to die, precisely because it doesn't last forever, precisely because it's limited. And therefore, a human being has to look at life in terms of the opportunities in terms of making the Chafetz Chaim, making the 10 minutes count, making the minute count, not putting off for later the business of repairing fences that we can do today, because a person doesn't know. Mm-hmm. The Maggid of Kelim was a famous preacher, an itinerant Maggid of the 19th century. He used to go around, and he used to give, he used to speak from town to town. You know, the rabbis in those days, they only spoke twice a year, Shabbos HaGadol and Shabbos Shvi. They didn't give it. The rabbi of the community did not give a drasha in those days. Kind of missed that. But they only spoke twice a year, but they had itinerant preachers who would go around. And the Maggid of Kelim was a famous preacher, and he once gave a mashal right before Rosh Hashanah about, he was in Bialystok. Bialystok, you may know, had a large Jewish population, but also many, many secular Jews, even in the 19th century. Many Jews were not that religious in Bialystok, but they would come to Shul on Rosh Hashanah. So he gave a parable, he says, a miracle happened that there was Techiyas HaMesim, there was resurrection of the dead, of the old cemetery in Bialystok. And Hashem decreed they are given 1/2 hour to come back to this earth. And hundreds of people came into the shuls, and they pulled out gemaras, and they put on talis and tefillin, and they davened, and they prayed, and they said tehillim with tremendous fervor. They didn't talk to each other, they didn't talk to their families who were survivors, because they only had another 1/2 hour to get in what they could do. And as the clock is ticking, there's 5 minutes past, 10 minutes past, 10, 15 minutes past, and the fervor gets greater and greater and greater. And you see, because you know there are 5 minutes left, and imagine what it's like. And the altar of Kelim, or not the altar of Kelim, the Maggid of Kelim, stopped his drasha and said, "And what's so bad if Hashem gave us more than 1/2 hour to do it? And how do you know that we have 1/2 hour to do it?" He says, "If a person were to be told they only have 1/2 hour before they leave the world." Again, it's scary, and I don't want to upset anybody, but what would you do? What would you do? Okay, you find something that would be worthwhile. And, you know, you don't know. Amir Tashem, you know, we should have Mayav Yisrim Shana. But the point is, the lesson here is not that one should be morbid and fearful, but that one should recognize the irreplaceable value of time. And there's so many things that we put off. You know, the Gemara has a story. Of Soloveitchik, that's how I used to quote this Gemara a lot, about how human beings don't appreciate what they have till they miss it, till it's no longer here. And he would tell the story that the Gemara says in Brachos that when Rav was one of the great Amoram, one of the great rabbis in the Gemara, he was called Rav, the rabbi, that's what he was called. His name was actually Abba. That when he died, all of his students ripped their garments because he was like their father to them. They ripped their garments. And on the way back from the funeral, they stopped by a river and they washed their hands to eat bread. And they were sitting at different places. And then the question arose, since they were sitting at different spots, should they get together for a mezumah? Mm-hmm. And like instinctively, they said, well, let's ask Rav what the halacha is. And then they kind of, you know, the way it happens sometimes, you know, you think the person's still alive, and then they realized he's not here anymore. And they ripped their garments a second time. And they said, you know, Rav died and we never even bothered to find out how you bench. Mm. You know, if we had another minute with him, we could have asked him. You know, we can't ask him. Mm. And Rav Soloveitchik writes that often when he prepared, he had very famous Yahrzeit shiurim for his father. So when he used to prepare shiur, he would often say, you know, if he only had his father for 5 minutes, he could ask him this. Now he knows he doesn't. You know, so he was talking about the concept of, you know, what we're going to feel or what we do feel when we don't have. Mm-hmm. We should try to know when we do have and act accordingly. And that's really, so if you look at Havel Havolim, it's not so much futility or worthlessness. But you look at Havel Havolim as the tragedy of that which is so transient and ephemeral. And the message, therefore, is to try to make that moment count. So then Koheles becomes a very life-affirming book in that sense, meaning to say he is affirming the significance of existence. That which is forever, ironically, has less significance because, you know, you can put it off, you know, I'll do it and I'll do that in 1,000 years. I'll have time then. Now, there's another aspect in Kohelis, though, and that is Kohelis recognizes that the life is very hard sometimes, the world is difficult, but he does talk very much, and people often don't note this in Kohelis, but Kohelis talks about the importance of relationships to get a person through the difficulties of life. He says, Tovim Hashnayim Mino Echad, two people are, right, the famous the saying in English, two people are better than one. But he talks about it in this way, he says, because if one person is pushed down, the other person can lift him up. But if one person is alone and they get pushed down, who will ever be able to pick them up? Right? Meaning, looking at life as a situation where you do get pushed down, you do get crushed, but you need someone to pick you up. Right? And so Kohelis is actually suggesting that one of the ways a person navigates through the difficulties that life puts in their way is through creating a connection with others. Now, all of this is very, very relevant to Sukkot. Let me explain why we read this on Sukkot. It's the basic thing. And that is, Sukkot, we know, was the height of the agricultural cycle. It was the end of the agricultural cycle. It was the time in which, after the summer, all of the fruit and all of the produce was brought into the houses after being in the fields. It's a time in which a person feels a lot of pride in their accomplishments, at least if they were successful with it. The Rashbam, in fact, this is Rashi's grandson, one of the great commentators, actually makes the point that the reason we leave our homes and be in the sukkah is because since sukkah is a time of pride, a person might think, Kochi v'yotzim yadi, all of my wealth came from my accomplishments, so he goes out, he exposes himself to the elements, he leaves his comfortable house and goes into the cold sukkah to recognize how vulnerable and dependent they are. In other words, the Rashbam sees the sukkah as a lesson in humility and humbleness and removing the arrogance. Kohelis, too, is read during Sukkot because it reminds us of how fragile our lives are, and it teaches us humility, and it teaches us how one should not waste their life just on accumulation of wealth, because that wealth does not last. It's like the onions, etc. That's one idea. But Sukkot, too, is very much a focus on relationships. Of all the Yomim Tovim, Sukkot has the greatest emphasis on creating bonds between human beings. I can prove this in a number of ways. You know, the Gemara says that there are three gifts that Hashem gave us in the Midbar. The manna, came in the merit of Moshe. The well came in the merit of Miriam, and the clouds of glory came in the merit of Aaron. Now, we know that Sukkot, one of the things Sukkot commemorates are the clouds of glory that came in the merit of Aaron. So why don't we have a holiday for the man or the well? Why do we only have a holiday for the Anane HaKavot? So one of the answers that's given is, the Jewish people got the man after they were arguing with Moshe and attacking Moshe and saying, you know, we're starving. And the well also came through machlokas. We only commemorate those gifts that came to us through peace and not those gifts that came through strife and machlokas. We also know, too, that the Anane HaKavod came in the merit of Aaron. And what was Aaron's outstanding characteristic? Lover of peace, pursuer of peace. So in effect, what is Hashem saying? If you want to experience the sheltering embrace of Hashem that is the sukkah, you have to be ohev shalom, a lover of peace, a pursuer of peace. We have to be Aaron in order to merit the Anane HaKavod, the clouds of glory. Right? We have to merit that. Another thing, of course, is another, again, I'm just trying to show you how sukkah is connected to relationships and interconnections. The lulav and the esrog. We talked about this. This is the well-known medrash. I'm sure all of you have heard. We mentioned it last week also, that the four species represent the four types of Jews, that the esrog, which has a good fragrance and good taste, is the Jew with Torah and good deeds. The lulav is the fruit without the fragrance. That's the Torah without the good deeds, without the chesed. The hadasim are the fragrance without the taste. That's good deeds without the Torah. And the Areva is the person with no smell, nothing. Again, unity. You have to take it together. God says, I want there to be that connection. So in effect, the theme of Sukkot is relationships, because it is only through the love that we show for others that we could be zoche to the Anane HaKavod. And therefore, the two themes of Koheles, one is not to live your life for the material world, but to recognize a higher purpose of submission to God, and the need to connect to others in order to serve Hashem properly. All of that is mirrored in Koheles, and those are the themes of Sukkot itself. Okay, so Sukkot is connected to the book of Koheles. Okay, I guess that's it for me.
So,
yeah.
What does Koheles suggest, telling us in terms of
question.
Material pursuits, or do we just keep very low expectations to just live minimally? Serve Hashem?
I think Koheles is saying you should have priorities in life, but when you have that priority, you can in fact take your material wealth and serve Hashem. I don't think Koheles is calling for poverty. When Koheles says,
not
for example,
poverty,
Koheles says, well, he makes the point. He makes the obvious point that a person can, like Ezer Ashir, Sameach Mechelka, that a person can be very happy with very little. Mm-hmm. And one should not strive for excessive material acquisition, but one should strive, whatever they do, they serve Hashem. He's not advocating renunciation, but he's saying that acquisition should not be any person's uppermost mind, because it's not going to last forever. Again, those are wise words. Listen, the Medrash points out that these are the experiences he himself observed as he's wandering from place to place. And that's what Sukkot, as I mentioned last week, Sukkot is a symbolic divestiture of our possessions. We leave the home. We expose ourselves to the elements. We understand what it's like to be poor and to be homeless. And in that way, we learn that we don't need all of those things that we normally think we need. Well, there are symbols.
We have to go to every bad thing in order to relate to
Well, the Torah itself says that the reason why one has compassion for the stranger is because you were strangers in Egypt. So the concept that what a person goes through gives them sympathy is a human nature that the Torah recognizes.
I understand that. It's a very benign way to just remember the concept.
It's a symbol that makes you think about it.
What do you call,
the Torah gives
us
those
bad
things?
Ways. It's all relative. Yeah. I mean, bad thing could be living in Africa without any Jews around.
That's right. Bad thing
could be different, you know. Mm-hmm. It's all relative.
But the thing is that one has to learn sympathy and empathy from that, not
do we all have to be homeless to appreciate the homeless? Is that right?
Well, I think that when a person has that experience, they feel it more powerfully than if they didn't.
Well, I don't think that everybody has to go through that, but not too hard about
it. I understand. But those who have gone through it have a certain dimension of their feeling that others might not.
Right.
But you should say that everybody should be homeless in order to...
No. But this is a symbolic way of doing it. This is not a complete homelessness. Okay, I wish everyone has a good Yom Tov. By the way, you want to think about Shmini Atzeres. Now, Shmini Atzeres is a separate holiday. It is not part of Sukkot at all. In Eretz Yisrael, for example, you will not sit in the Sukkot whatsoever. The only reason why we eat in the Sukkot is because, since we have this doubt, Shmini Atzeres is a suffolk whether it's still the seventh day, so that's why we eat in the Sukkah. But Shmini Atzeres is a very mysterious holiday, because Shmini Atzeres does not have any ritual associated. There's no lulav, esrog. There really is no Sukkah in Eretz Yisrael, for example. But it's said that Shmini Atzeres is the extra day, because during Sukkot we bring 70 bulls, 70 korbanos for all the nations of the world. And Shmini Atzeres, it is said that Hashem says, if a melech makes a party for all of the countries in his empire, so after all the countries go away, the melech says to his best friend, let's just have a private lunch, you and me together, and forget about all the crowds. So Shmini Atzeres is said to be the private, intimate day that Hashem has with Bnei Yisrael. There's no umos ha'olam involved. There's no one else around. And that's Atzeres. Atzeres means to hold back. Stay a while. Everyone else is gone. stay with me an extra day. And Shmini Atzeres, therefore, is said to be a very, very exalted and holy Yom Tov. A Yom Tov that is so exalted that there's nothing in the world of action that it can be done. Meaning to say, it's a spiritual elevation that's above the concretization of mitzvahs. And in effect, therefore, it is said to be the attempt to experience the sukkah without the sukkah. Meaning, experience God's clouds of glory. It's like a practice exercise. We had 7 days in the sukkah, but now Hashem, so I'm taking away the sukkah, and you should feel my presence even without the sukkah.
But
so that's Shmini Atzeres. Yeah.
If you relate to a child, for instance, that they should live in the Yetzer Hara, they're basically good, and that they should, you know, that kind of thing, how would you approach that?
No, I would certainly stress they're basically good, and they should take their goodness and do more with it. I wouldn't talk about them as being bad at all. I would just say that, you know, take your good things and develop them and strengthen them and do more with them. Sure, sure, of course. The point is not to be bad, but the point is also to recognize that we have to grow as servants of Hashem. Okay, wish you all a good Moed, a good Yom Tov, and be well.